The Millennial Express, plowing ever onward through a northern winter. From station to station, bringing the dissident right to you.
Hello and welcome back to Millennial 2023. I'm now here with Lady of Shalott. Lady of Shalott is known to quite a few people. She's often appears in the. I see her in all sorts of comment sections in our movement, and she has her own YouTube channel now. I guess I should just address you as Milady.
Yes, that's fine.
Can you introduce yourself to the audience?
I will indeed. Thank you so much. Hello, everyone. I'm Lady of Shalott. I moderate on a number of channels. I have a little small channel of my own, which I started this year. I'm a former academic. I grew up in Northern Ireland. I lived in England. I lived in Australia about 20 years ago, and I moved back to Australia in January 2020, just before COVID. I currently teach online and run a homeschooling group, and just try and sort of make sense of the madness of the world.
Right. And could you describe the your political evolution, where you are now? I think we all can guess roughly where you are, but what brought you here?
What brought me here? I grew up in a very conservative culture in Northern Ireland. You've got to remember what Ireland was like. Back then, there was no abortion available anywhere on the island of Ireland. It was very, very, very conservative. When I went to work in England, I had a real culture shock, and didn't like it at all. Came to Australia first as a postgrad student and loved it here. Australia was already starting to change at that point. Australia changed massively under John Howard, who was really a technocrat. And he started the mass immigration. That would have been in the early late 90s, 2000s. He was the longest serving, what they say liberal here, which is meant to be conservative, but really it's just a label. And he really started the mass immigration into Australia. It had already been going on since the end of the White Australia policy in the 70s. But the country was still, I suppose, what you would call quite what British people might like to call quite based when I was here first. But when I moved back permanently, I noticed an enormous change, and it really shocked me. And unfortunately, I live in a city, the city of Melbourne, which is the wokest.
I'm sorry to be pedantic, but when did you move away from Australia?
Oh, golly, that would have been, I was here as a postgrad student, so that would have been about over 20 years ago, so I can really see the difference.
Right, okay.
The change in the country.
Understand.
Yeah.
I
came back. Yeah, I came back and lived in England. I taught in England. I worked there. I have an Australian husband, but my children were all born in Yorkshire. I lived in South Yorkshire for years. I was an academic then. But then eventually we finally moved back to Australia in the beginning of 2020, and it had changed massively. But again, I'm living in the Death Star. I'm in Melbourne, which is the most libtard leftist city in Australia. But that change has happened here. The same, you can say what's happened to Australia. Well, the same thing happened to Australia has happened everywhere else. That it got.
So yeah, as an outsider, it's perhaps all.
Yes, yeah, I think that you see it when you are an outsider. You see it in sharp focus, maybe in a way that people who've lived here continuously and have been the boiling frog maybe don't see it in the same way. I was really, really shocked at how much it had changed, and that was before we went into the lockdowns, and just went off the cliff.
Yeah, of course. Well, we'll get to that. But why don't you describe the changes that you saw because I want to get into detail here, because it obviously matters, it's important, and then we can get into the more authoritarian side of it with COVID.
Oh, just the whole rise of identity politics. It had just changed so much that Australians were generally quite politically conservative, but that had really gone. The identity politics had gripped the country.
It's the rainbow flag, BLM.
Yeah. Kind of thing. Yeah. Well, the BLM thing was kind of, it was, I know you were talking to Furious Pertinax yesterday and he mentioned it. Here, it was kind of co-opted by the Aboriginal industrial complex people, the people who were pushing.
Before in my life.
It really is here. I mean, when we get on to discussing the amount of money that is spent on Aboriginal affairs here and the voice, you'll see that it really is an industrial complex here. And the whole BLM thing was just co-opted by the people who are pushing the Aboriginal rights agenda. So there were marches in Melbourne, but they used the Aboriginal flag and it became... And of course, Aboriginals have got nothing to do with United States politics at all. But why waste a situation if you can co-opt it and use it? And that's what the leftists here did, and they did it. It was galling because they were out protesting at a time that the rest of us were told we couldn't go more than 5 kilometres from where we lived. Mm. And the state permitted their protests but didn't permit the protests of the anti-lockdown people and the what became known here as the freedom movement. It's the classic thing that anyone who goes against the regime will have the weight of the regime upon them.
But before we get to that, did you also notice a change in the culture around, you know, gay rights and trans?
Oh, was completely.
That, I think by 2019, early 2020, that was fully, pretty much fully blossomed by then, wasn't it?
Oh, my goodness, yeah. Australia had the vote on same-sex marriage. I think it was in 2016, 2017, and about 66% of the population voted in favour of that. But, of course, I mean, 66 isn't exactly a landslide, but, of course, the left seized on that and said that it was, and it showed that Australia was this great country now, that there was going to be no more of the old bigotry, and, changed... Mm. Completely.
Yeah. And I think, you know, when I think back to Australia in the 90s, I've never been to Australia.
Oh, goodness.
my experience of Australia is really limited to watching copious numbers of episodes of Neighbours.
Me too, until I came here. Yeah.
And also Crocodile Dundee.
Oh dear. I hate to tell you woes, but Crocodile Dundee is dead. You know, that type of Australia is. That's gone. Abby, interesting that film, you will never see that film shown on the mainstream TV here. And if you do, it will be very, very heavily edited because apparently it's full of homophobic and rude references.
I think there was a tranny joke in it as well somewhere. Yes. But it's so many. The thing is, I think we must have recorded it off TV one year. One way or another, it was a thing in my childhood, and we watched it again and again. I did also see the sequel, and I think they did a third one, like in the 2000s.
I think they did.
And I'd never seen that. But the first and second, I think I can't remember what happens at the second, but the first one is the big popular film that I think many people will remember and will have seen, you know, once. And I think even then it was supposed to be off another era. Like he was a throwback to a...
Oh, most definitely. Most definitely. Yeah, he was. I mean, he really was. Even then, when it was made in, I think, 86, I remember I was at school, it was a throwback. But yeah, that kind of world, it's just, I mean, what represents Australia now is the city bugman. Really, it is. And you will see them everywhere in Melbourne and Canberra and in the inner cities. And again, most of the, I think it's some crazy statistic. I looked at the results of the 2021 census and it's something like 88% of Australians live in cities or what they call, they are urbanized So this idea of the outback Aussie is just, it's part of the mythology, really, in some ways.
And I think in the film it's like that as well. But the other thing I wanted to say about that is that the actor who played him, Paul Hogan. He used to have I caught an episode of this. He used to have a comedy show in the 70s or the 80s, before he hit it big with that film. He was a comedian in Australia. And I saw an episode of it, and it was the most... It was very, very sort of sexist.
Oh, completely. Yeah.
I don't know if it was overtly racist, but it was definitely often, it was rough and ready, very macho, male sort of humor.
Most definitely. That's what it was like.
Unreconstructed.
Oh, God. When I first came here as a postgrad student, I'd have like male professors saying really suggestive stuff. And I'd think, if we were in a British university, you could be arrested for that. They were still lagging a bit behind here then, but my goodness, did they ever put the brakes on, get off the brakes and put the accelerator down and catch up?
And it changed a lot.
The
other thing I wanted to mention was Neighbours, and some people might not know what Neighbours is. It's a soap opera set on a residential suburban street called Ramsay Street in Melbourne.
In Melbourne.
I think it also started in 86, and it was always, I think, at least as popular in Britain as it was in Australia. And so it was syndicated, and it was shown on the BBC, and I used to watch it a lot as a child, in the late 80s through to, about 93, 94. And loads of people watched it, especially kids, for some reason.
It was put on at lunchtime, so it caught the lunchtime, the sort of people, like the retired people, housewives, anybody who's around at lunchtime. And then it was on at 5 o'clock when
that's
it was
right,
before
after
the news.
BBC and before the news. That's right. Yeah.
It was a fantastic promotion. It and Home and Away did great PR for Australia because it promoted a kind of easygoing, nice lifestyle where all your neighbours are lovely and it's all great here and everybody has a lovely Labrador.
Yeah. And the other thing is that it was very much about normal people.
Yes.
And sort of, it was almost dull in the sense that there were no, I don't think there was like a goth kid in the 80s.
No.
Everyone was mainstream. Everyone was normal. I don't know if there was a religious, people were Christian. I can't remember now. There might have been a bit of that, and maybe some of the other characters would roll their eyes. I honestly don't know. But it was very much normal and conservative.
Yeah, very, very.
Small C conservative values that were in
and
this.
You might get the occasional teenage tear away, but then they'd usually be sorted out by this sort of old patriarch, like Alf from Home and Away, who would sort of give them a clip around the ear and call them a stupid galah or something like that.
And then
everything would be all right in the end.
Yeah, and teenage tearaways, that was seen as a rebellious phase governed by hormones, by chemical, because what do you expect? He's 15, he's 17,
exactly.
his blood's up, It wasn't seen as a socio-political statement. It was seen as a rowdy teenage boy fancying himself as some kind of revolutionary, when really it's just it's hormones. And that's important because that's the polar opposite of what teenage rebellion is, the way it's seen now, which is as a glorious, noble rebellion against the norm. So it's very much the opposite. And I guess that brings us to this whole thing. So Neighbours, that it was a sort of dull, staid defence of the norm. And as I say, from the vantage point of Britain, we all watched it, but there was almost something too staid about it.
Yes.
People would mock it for this.
They would.
Yeah, nothing. They would. There's no subculture on Ramsay Street. There are no foreigners on Ramsay Street. Everyone's white. Everyone's conservative, and so forth. And that was the culture that Australia was happily exporting. The image of itself that it was happily exporting all around the world in the 80s and 90s. So I think it's, I just want to set that, I think it really sets the, and of course, the more crass stuff of Crocodile Dundee and Paul Hogan, that's a previous era where it was less refined.
Yes.
So the Neighbours, like Harold, is the more refined version of Paul Hogan.
Yeah.
But it's absolutely. Still, it's the same sort of mentality of...
Oh, goodness, it was all like really, really, really really wholesome.
Oh, yeah.
You know, by
standards of today, it's unimaginably wholesome.
Oh, my goodness. Melbourne suburbs aren't like that anymore.
Well,
I hate to break it to the viewers.
Yeah. So that brings us to 2020. And you went back and it had changed radically in those 20 years.
Oh, my
years.
Goodness. Yeah.
And demographically, trans, and the identity politics and so forth. And then a few months after you arrived.
6 weeks. Goodness, not even. Yeah, 6 weeks. It was great. And then it wasn't. Yeah.
So how did it start?
Oh, well, we started out with that it was very similar to how it was in the UK. Well, we're just going to have to lock down for a little while. You know, it's about flattening the curve. And I think a key player that we haven't mentioned in this is Dan Andrews, who was the state premier at the time. He was a Labour leader. He recently resigned. He resigned a couple of months ago. But at this time, he was omnipresent and he would be on the TV every day, wagging his finger at us. And we were only supposed to have a short lockdown. Initially we did for a while, but then in the end, Melbourne had 6 lockdowns, totaling, I think it was about 262 days in total. It was the world's longest lockdown, but it actually was a series of 6 lockdowns. So we'd be in it and then we'd be out of it. And in some ways that was worse because it gave people a little bit of taste of normality and then we were straight back in it.
And false hope.
It was just disastrous.
And false hope as well.
False hope, yeah.
Yeah. So I think from the perspective of the rest of the world, Australia and especially Victoria seemed like a testing bed for fairly extreme policies. I think maybe Jacinda Ardern in New Zealand was maybe slightly worse. I don't know. Dan Andrews, she as a person is more obviously awful than Dan Andrews, who just seems kind of dull. would you have a different opinion there?
I think he's deeply sinister. He is a great ally of China and has spent, he used to go off on trips to China and no media were allowed to follow or take photographs. And he's really in league with the CCP and he's quite a threatening, he would come on to the TV and his broadcasts and, you know, wag his finger at us. And, you know, he has a dear leader complex, you know, that we are just his little subjects and he's going to threaten us, but it's for your own good. And he's a very, very sinister man. Very sinister. I mean, he resigned a couple of months ago after there was a whole debacle about the Commonwealth Games. As you might be aware that Melbourne was supposed to host the Commonwealth Games. And then he just dropped the Commonwealth Games people like a ton of bricks and we couldn't afford it because there's no money here. The state is in so much debt and we can't afford to host a sporting event. It's great for the state because Melbourne will never get another sporting event again now. Because who on earth would trust the government here to give them anything? But he resigned. But he's a very, very, very sinister. And, you know, there's a culture of bullying within the Labour Party here. And many of his colleagues, ex-colleagues, who left the party accused him of bullying, and I could absolutely believe. And he just reminds me of the worst type of school bully. I mean, if he'd been at my school in Belfast, he would have had his head put down the toilet and the chain flushed, you know, that sort of thing, for being a nasty bully. And he's a very sinister character. Yeah,
I remember,
I remember him saying
that your life is going to be difficult if you don't get vaccinated.
So it was
kind of thing. Yeah, I'm sure he wasn't lying. It's the fact that he just explicitly said it. It's not, but then again, Jacinda Ardern saying that there are going to be two tiers of people, the vaxxed and the unvaxxed. And Trudeau, I've got to say, it really is these Anglosphere, it's just Canada, New Zealand and Australia, I think we're worse than Britain and certainly worse than America as a whole. Or any American state, actually. It just seemed awful. And Trudeau, I don't want to go too off topic, but I don't blame people for utterly hating that man after 2021. I think, when was the trucker thing? Was that 22? Yes, I think it was.
That was, yeah, I remember that well.
Just before Ukraine. And his actions there were sort of the culmination of the Canadian COVID era. Certainly authoritarian, to say the least. It's not an exaggeration. Freezing people's bank accounts just for having made a donation to the truckers. Yeah. That was astonishing. Yeah. But
it's terrifying. It's terrifying.
Yeah. To get back to our friend Dan Andrews. why do you think he resigned? Was there any explanation for that?
Oh, I think he just decided he would just go on his own terms. There was a massive celebration in the city with people who would have been going to the protests and the freedom movement. And I just couldn't see the point in it, because in the end, he resigned on his own terms. He left when it suited him. He left with an enormous pension payout. And now he's playing golf, and he is being mooted to run again for actually to be in Parliament, not a state premier. There's a vacant seat in Canberra, and he may well be going back into politics and just by running to be an MP. And the thought of him getting anywhere near power again is terrifying. But you know, these people, he'll be parachuted in there, and I wouldn't be at all surprised. I really wouldn't. I mean, he got re-elected. We had a state premiership election here in November of last year, and he was re-elected after everything that happened here. And so many of us believe, well, there's no way he's gone now. There's no way he'll be re-elected. He was re-elected. So, you know,
I mean, presumably that was the people who did, the public who did that, who voted it back in.
Yeah.
Don't know what to think. I guess they were so persuaded by the COVID propaganda that they were grateful for these measures that politicians.
Oh, like my him. Goodness. Yeah. I did some volunteering for some of the small parties here, and I had old people telling me, oh, but he saved our lives. And you just think, good grief. You know, do you really think that by him locking you indoors for the best part of 2 years, he saved your life? You can't reach people like that, it was the same. It was kind of the same playbook that played out in the United Kingdom, as you say, New Zealand, United States. But I think here it was just worse, and I think it is due to how urban Australia is, that if you're in one of these big cities, it's very, very easy to control you and lock you down. And of course, Australia has a culture of strong policing. It's always been a strongly policed country. Mm-hmm. And
I don't want to be facetious, but would that be because of how it started?
Yeah, absolutely. Right. It's a country, you know, the mythology would tell you it's a country of convicts, but really it's a country of jailers and their children, and the free settlers too. But it's a very, very authoritarian country. And when I first came here, I was kind of shocked by the number of rules. There would be rules for everything, and people always liked to point out to you, just regular people point out to you, that you were breaking those rules.
Is this in the late 90s?
Yeah, late 2000s. Yeah, they would tell you, you know, you're not, you can't do that, or you can't, you know, you need to know that. What? I think British people are generally like, well, it's none of my business to do that. And, oh, you know, it doesn't matter. And I think you can kind of muddle through a bit more in Britain. But over here, I think the scariest thing about this place is that everything works. You know, they've got a tax system. Once you're in that matrix, they've kind of got you. And because it's a state federal crossover, and there really isn't, everything here works. And a huge number of people work for the government, work in the public sector, employs a massive amount of people. And you just find it's very, very hard to get away with anything here. I'm just laughing about it, but I've had so many parking tickets and speed and things and this and that. You know, it's speed cameras everywhere here, and it's a very, very controlled place. And I think it, and that shocked me because I always thought Australia was really easy going, and you come here and you realize it kind of isn't.
Yeah. I've actually heard the same about Canada, oddly enough.
Yes. Yeah.
Very rule bound and very bureaucratic, lots of red tape, yeah. Little things in daily life.
So endless.
But it doesn't surprise me with Australia. It's kind of, it goes with the culture, the stereotype. It does seem like quite, and again, unless you're Paul Hogan, in which case you just don't give a fuck kind of thing.
Yeah.
And everyone else is going to be Harold on Ramsay Street, minding his P's and Q's quite diligently.
Oh, if you don't get a foot, and it's all done with fines. You know, if you don't, I recently didn't get a foreman at the right, and I got a fine. And if you don't pay that, then the fine's bigger and bigger. And what was happening during the COVID lockdowns, when people infringed the COVID regulations, they were being issued with enormous fines of $5,452 for breaking one of these COVID rules and being taken to court. And if they didn't pay, what was happening in some of the states was the money was being taken directly from your bank account, because of course they have all your details on a database somewhere and they can do that. It's terrifying, you know, that the state will just go into your account and take your money.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that must create a sense of powerlessness.
Yeah. Most definitely. And I mean, we had the series of protests here against the lockdowns, and they really culminated about 2 years ago in November 2021. They were huge, but as with all protests, it didn't go anywhere. All that energy, the leaders didn't really seem to know what to do with it. It just fizzled out. And when the lockdowns ended, they had lost a purpose, really. It's an awful shame, because there were a group of people there who did feel very, very aggrieved. And I went to some of the protests, but it was co-opted again by single issues like Aboriginal rights and this and that. And that's the problem with protests. They don't work.
And I think, before we get into the broader issue of protests, with lockdown and COVID and those protests, I think it was similar again with the truckers in Canada, where no one really knows how do you protest? How do you demand something? And then what do you do when you don't get it? Yep. What's the next step? What's the procedure kind of thing? There was a quote about the January the 6th insurrection, the nonsense on January the 6th. So I think it was, I can't remember the guy's name, but anyway, he said it was like a video gamers where they got into the capital and they thought, and then they just milled around confused as to why the level wasn't ending.
Yeah.
And I think that was a very interesting observation, that they thought, well, we've done the thing, so now surely it will just take care of itself. Like, there, something will happen. There'll be a response and then we'll get onto the next level and then we'll do that and we'll progress. But actually they found that there is no game plan here. There is no procedure. There is no response set up to deal with your demands. Just because you've entered the Capitol building doesn't mean anything. You're now going to be punished for entering. Your life is going to be fucked now for entering the Capitol building. That's going to be your reward, Mario. And you're going to be made to regret doing this. And I think in a similar, obviously that's a harsh, with January the 6th and with the truckers is very harsh, but the general point remains that the idea people have in their heads that you protest and that means you get what you want, that's a completely fictitious idea, I think implanted in us over the course, the second half of the 20th century, by protest movements that were astroturfed. So the establishment would arrange for, or one way or another would coax, would make happen a protest movement that it wanted to happen. So
exactly.
That so they would get the reward for, they would go out and protest for what they wanted, and then they'd get what they wanted because the establishment had it all planned all along. That's I think how things like gay rights, women's lib, and so on, I'm sure a lot of them did genuinely feel that they were speaking truth to power. Mm. Probably was a very convincing dream that they were in, but it was, I think, a dream. I think they weren't really rebelling. They weren't really going against what the establishment wanted. Quite the reverse. But if that's your image of protest, then you think that, well, I and a lot of other people want X, so I know what we've got to do. We've got to do what the women's lib people did and the gay rights mm-hmm. people did and the whatever other protest movements did, and it will work. And so it's a very, I'm sorry, I'm explaining this in overly
wordy exactly. terms, but
I find it quite fascinating that we've been fed this fake idea and how elaborate that whole thing is, the deception. And so then we try it and we find that the reality is actually very different. Would you have anything to say about that?
Totally agree. You know, there were a few prominent, but one in particular, there was a woman called Monica Smith that emerged from the freedom movement. She actually spent time in prison because she refused to give up details from her phone to the police and contacts and things like that. And they wouldn't give her bail, and she spent quite a long time in prison. And, you know, that was really her kind of peak moment. And now she just sort of does the round. She was actually on Elijah Schaefer's program recently. He's in Australia now and slightly offensive. But you know, that they're directionless. What did they achieve? What you could say, and I think in fairness to that movement, it did bring people together. And I met people there and was able maybe to make contacts, and then you could network a little bit and you met people, but beyond networking, didn't achieve anything at all. Because it was never going to go anywhere.
Yeah, that's the other thing that I think a lot of us discovered, and I wasn't part of any protests, but I observed, a lot of us discovered that protest, not only does it not get you what you want, but it's actually a very difficult thing to sustain. Because if you don't get the little wins along the way, people very quickly get demoralized. And that in turn suggests that not only was the establishment helping those protests, but it also had people in place to lead them who knew what they were doing, who were trained, and I'm not saying that, you know, FBI, everyone's an FBI agent. It doesn't need to be like that. I'm just saying they knew what they were doing in a way that amateurs trying this for the first time simply didn't know what they were doing. And there was a report that came out from someone who was inside the trucker movement, and he was reporting what it was like. And he said it was shambolic, and people, no one knew what they were doing. They were basically hoping for the best. And I'm sure it was the same in Britain,
completely.
The same in Australia.
Completely. And I've no doubt that the movement was completely infiltrated by ACO, which is our version of CIO, feds, whatever you want to call it. I'm absolutely certain that there were lots of those characters in it. And it's a shame, because people just felt hopeless and felt no one was listening to them. And what do you do? But it's a bit like a toddler stamping their feet. You know, if you think all that's going to happen is you're just going to be put on the naughty step or sent to bed. You're not going to get given into.
Yeah, it's like the thing about a parent just letting the toddler scream their lungs out until they're exhausted, and then, that's that then, sort of thing. I think a similar thing happened here, where they let you sometimes they don't let you protest, but sometimes they do, and it just fizzles out. Someone else has made a very good point in the comments that the protests often receive little or no media coverage.
Which completely. Is, yeah,
perfect
that's
way
right.
To demoralize people, because
they just ignored it. Yeah, The main broadcaster here, of course, is the ABC, which is even worse than the BBC, if that is actually possible. But then you have this myriad of other channels like Channel 7, Channel 9. They just generally ignored it or of course, said it was a far-right protest. Really, Sky News Australia was the only channel that really kind of gave it any serious coverage. And even then, it didn't give it very much. I mean, people like to think that Sky News Australia is incredibly based. It really isn't.
I mean, it's better than the BBC.
Oh, it's a million times better. But I think, you know, that the charge of controlled opposition is often thrown at it. And they used to have they had a journalist on there who had people on who were he spoke against the COVID vaccine, and he very quickly got the sack, a journalist called Alan Jones. They got rid of him. So, look, you know, these people aren't going to bang the drum for you, only if it suits them.
Yeah. Yeah. They know what they're doing.
Yes.
And they know what they're certainly not supposed to do, which is help protests against the government. I do find it very interesting. I think this is a whole thing, a whole area where dissidents of every stripe are going to have to learn an awful lot and do an awful lot of study and thought and planning and collaborate an awful lot. And you know, the era of falling out with each other over nothing has to absolutely end. Anyone who's behaving in an antisocial manner should be ostracized immediately, because they are just ruining it for everyone else and retarding the chances of success at any level. I mean, I can't emphasize this enough. And as things get worse, things get more desperate, the window for tolerating that kind of behavior and that kind of personality gets ever smaller.
Absolutely. I mean, I think the word that you use, retardation, is a very appropriate one. We can never move forward if we just spend all day fighting with each other.
Yeah, it's a thing. It's a problem. I think when we were all banned from Twitter, or most of us, we were on Telegram, and it was a sort of closed shop, and a lot of people just took to arguing with each other and fighting with each other. Mm. And that's a good, but it happened long before that anyway. I saw it, and you know, I've only been in this for 10 years. People will have much longer memories than I have. It's a problem on the right, I think, in fringe politics in general, dissident politics in general, but especially on the right, because we tend to be, you know, headstrong, disagreeable, and obsessed with moral purity and, ideological purity, which I think is a huge problem.
Absolutely. And I think, I mean, this is just an observation as a woman, that sometimes it can be male egos as well, because it is a movement that is massively dominated by men, of course. And to me, it just seems that there is a lot, just so many clashes. And it's unfortunate, because it retards any progress.
It does. It does in multiple ways. I mean, maybe I should write an essay about this next year, but I've fallen out with people, and I try my absolute best not to, but it has happened. And you know, it's been pointed out that I'm sort of hypocritical, being self-righteous here. But look, I've tried not to fall out with people. Where it has happened, it's been unavoidable. People are always going to fall out. It's a reality. But that doesn't mean that you should then spread rumours about each other, or piss out of each other, or try to sabotage each other. Just leave each other alone. That's all you really have to do. Just leave each other alone. It's not rocket science. I think that,
absolutely. Well, yeah.
And I don't want to dwell too much on this. It was just a side point that I think my point was this. Idea that we can behave like this and expect to succeed is completely ridiculous.
I think just to close up that topic, that I mean, I'm one of the, well, there aren't many women in this kind of scene, and I'm maybe a little bit older than some people in the scene, and I also have children, and I teach children who are quite troubled, some of them. One thing you learn is you learn to pick your fights. And if you're going to spend all day fighting with everyone, you're not going to get anything done. And I think people just maybe need to step back and just pick your fights and prioritize your time and your energy.
Yes, definitely. I always think, what is good for the movement? What is good for the overall cause? And also, what would make our enemies laugh? What would our enemies love us to do? And generally speaking, it's this kind of thing. It's this kind of behavior. We must delight our enemies. They don't even need
it
to.
Does. Fights, you it know? Does. It does. And they have their in fights too. The goal. I was in Ireland. I've got family in Ireland, and I was in Ireland at the time of the same-sex marriage vote. And once that vote was won, the very same activists, the very next day, focused on the abortion issue. They don't stop for breath. They're straight on, and they do have the internal disagreements, but they keep their eye on the prize.
Yeah, that's the thing. It's always they are able to think what is for the greater good. Hmm. And they don't, and this, they also don't spurg out too much about, well, that person doesn't agree with me 100%. he disagrees with me on that 2%. I'm going to get him for that 2%. But that's partly because the left, I think, are not so interested in morals as we on the right.
Not a bit.
But unfortunately, that's a boon for them, and it's a disadvantage for us, because it means that we obsess over this stuff. They don't care. You know, all they want is to win. And the thing is, they are prepared to do almost anything to win.
Almost anything, yes.
So we have to bear that in mind when, you know, the next time you're thinking of picking a fight with someone, just remember what I'm saying here.
Mm.
So I think that the whole thing, I mean, you said male egos. I think, yes.
Just a little bit. There's nothing wrong with that. There's absolutely nothing wrong with it.
Yeah, of course. I mean, ego is what propels a man forwards.
Yes,
It can have unhealthy sides as well. Even for him, well, especially for himself, actually.
Yeah.
But yeah, and as you say, the movement, I mean, I could mention female vanity, like the sort of queen bee syndrome, but there are so few women in the movement that it's almost not worth going into. But yeah, I agree with everything you've said there. So I think the bigger point was we have to get better at this. And anyone... Mm. I mean, I don't know how long I'll be in this for. I don't know. I don't know if I become prominent again, they'll start attacking me again. I don't know if I want that. Everyone has limits. But nonetheless, anyone who is in this and who wants to succeed, I think they have to get much better at what we've been doing and learn from the left, basically.
Mm.
I know people always say, well, they've got resources, they've got the establishment on their side. Yeah, that's true. But I think that we need to synthesize that for ourselves to whatever extent is possible.
Totally agree.
But yeah, this is your interview, so don't let me...
Oh, no, this is great. And it's great that we are talking about these things and that we can learn from the left.
Well, yeah, and I think a lot of people find that concept disgusting. Because it's like dirty, you know, it's like learning from Satan or something.
Learning from Vosh.
Yeah. Oh, God. Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Would you want to learn from this man?
some of my teenage children tell me that people on the left think Vosh is just a bit of a joke anyway. But yeah, you know, you don't have to be like them, but you can look at you don't have to be like the Bolsheviks, but you can look at what did they do? What were their tactics? How did they do it? You don't have to be them, but you can learn from how they achieved what they achieved.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I remember one time, and it was when I was in Amsterdam in 2017, and I saw there was this women's march going on, and we sort of walked into it. We didn't know it was going to be happening, and I remember standing there in this public park, and I mean, in retrospect, it's interesting to look at it from a historical perspective. It was probably funded by God knows how many NGOs.
NGOs.
And, you know, all the rest of it. But I remember standing, and I didn't think in those terms back then, because none of us did. But at the time, I just remember seeing that everything was fun. Like they made protest into fun. Whereas, you know, in the 70s, it wasn't fun. It was, you know, women being angry with their bras and burning their bras.
Yes, indeed,
It was quite hardcore. I think still manufactured, but nonetheless, quite hardcore, quite aggressive. By this time, leftist, feminist protest had become completely digestible for the masses, a fun thing to do on a Friday or whenever, whatever day it was. Just something to do. Just a way to kill some time in between your visits to Starbucks and Costa. You can then take part in this protest.
Yeah.
I mean, it's something else. Did you see that awful gay choir song from about two years ago?
Yes, I did, unfortunately. Awful. It was awful.
Hideous. But I remember one line that really interested me in that song where they said something like, you won't approve of where you're kids are going, and then the other one said to protests, and I thought, wow, what the suggestion there, the overall suggestion is that protest is just a part of normal life. It's not an accepted thing. It's something to do. It's like a lifestyle thing.
There was a school walkout here in schools in Australia and in Melbourne. A lot of school kids walked out of school a couple of weeks ago to support Palestine. And I mean, I know for a fact from some of my children that those kids couldn't tell you where Palestine was on a map, or they wouldn't know anything about Gaza. But it was just a bit of a LARP. It was something to do, you know, get you out of school for a couple of hours in the afternoon, and you can wander around the city, and it's fun.
It's a bit of fun, exactly. And I find this quite, it's disgusting, the idea of political protest just being actually just fun.
Yeah.
It's just something that anyone can do and everyone should do and everyone does do. I don't know. I could write about this. There's something hideous about it, that it's become all so prepackaged. And you know that in the case of, you know, leftist protests, it is entirely authorized by the powers that be. They want the 14, 15-year-old on a gay rights protest, not necessarily so that he'll be gay himself, but just so that his mind has nothing else in it but the idea of the rainbow. There's something really hideous about all of this.
But I think in that point, that's something where parents really have to step up, and if you don't pass life lessons on to your children, somebody else is going to fill that space. And it's a bitter pill, I think, for some parents to accept. And when their children go off down this avenue, and I had a difficult conversation with someone I once worked with about this, whose child had gone into the whole trans cult thing, and I said, but you know, what messages? What did you pass? What life lessons did you actually teach them? I mean, what did you tell them to stop them going down that road? Because if you don't, that space is going to be filled by something, and there's plenty of people out there who are going to quite happily do it.
Yeah, I remember seeing this thing about a married couple, and they had this teenage son, and I think that they were either atheists or milquetoast Christians. I can't remember which it was, but it doesn't really matter, because the point was that their philosophy was not to impose religion on their son. It's that should be something for him to make up his own.
No.
He became a Muslim.
Goodness me.
I mean, and you know, it's like, yeah, but you gave him nothing.
You gave him nothing.
So something else showed up to fill the void.
Yeah, you gave him nothing. So he sought out a religion and a belief system of absolutes. Because there's no middle ground. It's absolute.
And it's the search for identity. Crazy. It's the search for identity. When you're an adolescent, a teenager, you want to be something, someone, but your parents have made you a nondescript human. So what are you? And so you latch on to something. I mean, it's a cliche with subculture. You know, I'm a punk, I'm an emo, I'm a goth, a raver, and a hippie. And there was a period when I was growing up that was the thinking there, that he's latched onto this subculture so that he's something. It was a thing. And I think nowadays it's advanced to he's latched on to either Islam or political protest for its own sake as an actual lifestyle thing, or being a tranny of some kind.
Yes.
Because then he's something. So I think this is a huge problem. And again, I'm not a parent myself, so I don't want to preach at parents about how to do this and how to avoid this. I don't honestly know. I'm just saying clearly identity needs to be there, otherwise the person will seek one out, and it might well be something that you wouldn't approve of, and that will be alien to him and might well be very damaging to him.
That's what happens with all these kids who get captured by the trans cult. They're often very, very vulnerable, quite lost, and unfortunately there's a high crossover in the number who have autistic spectrum disorder and various other neurodivergencies who fall into this, and they just don't seem to have anybody to guide them, and it's really heartbreaking, really. Like I just feel awful. It's so bad.
It's monstrous. I mean, because the extent of it is hormones, puberty blockers, surgery. I mean, it's not like you're going to wear some goth clothes for a few months when you're 15 or something.
Get a tattoo, yeah.
Yeah.
It's not like that.
Yeah. It's life-changing permanently. And I mean, honestly, oh God, I could fed post so easily. The trouble is, and I actually do think that one day the stuff that's going on here is with the trans stuff is going to just seem horrendous. People are going to look back and think, what on earth was going on? How did this happen? And I don't even know what the answer to that question is. I don't really know how it's happened, except that it's been endless media pressure. But how do you get parents to be okay with this? I mean, it's a remarkable thing that we're seeing here.
There's a great book I'd recommend to anyone. This book is banned on Amazon. It's quite hard to get a hold of. I got it from Antelope Hill Press. It's called The Transgender Industrial Complex by Scott Howard. And Howard, he's written some fantastic books, but he follows the money. He does a huge amount of research and he follows the money back to where this came from and who's backing it. And it's really disturbing because it's all got a horrible inevitability about it. I don't know how much we can say on this stream, but the NGOs and the people who are backing this all seem to come from one place.
Yes, I can understand. Yeah. Australia.
Yeah, if only. I think you need to get on a plane and go travel more towards the Middle East. Yeah, yeah. It's terrible. It's really awful. It as a parent, I can't think of anything more horrible. But
no,
it happens.
Yeah, it's frightening because it is so real. I guess a lot of parents nowadays are probably thinking, well, it'll happen to someone else's kids.
It always happens to somebody else's kids. You know, when I worked in education, I would tell people about what was going on in school and they'd say, oh, that doesn't happen at my kid's school. And I think, doesn't it? When was the last time you actually checked in into what your children are learning? Do you know, I think a lot of parents, they just don't realize how bad things are in schools, or they do and they're in a level of denial because they think there's something they can do about it and they just hope that their kids will be okay. Or as you say, it's happening.
See, this is why I think that we need lots of talking between countries in the movement, because what's going on in one country will undoubtedly be going on in another if not already, soon or even before. So the thing is, what you were saying there was people don't know what goes on in their kids' schools. I think it was in Britain recently where a school was refusing to tell parents what it was teaching to kids by the way of sex education. And, you know, if that's happening here, it will be happening in other countries as well. And I know, even though they've got different legal systems, a whole different legal tradition, doesn't matter. The NGO apparatus will find a way to manipulate each legal system to its liking. And it will get away with doing this. And if that technique of simply keeping things from parents, if that technique works in one country, it will be used in another. So in a sense, I mean, this is the whole thing about globalism, really, isn't it? Is global, you know.
Absolutely,
tricks are the same everywhere. The stuff that the kids are taught will be roughly the, you know, in effect the same everywhere.
Absolutely. I mean, I was a parent governor in a nice Church of England school about 10 years ago when the Stonewall agenda started to come through top down, and we realized very quickly that there wasn't really going to be a great deal we could do about it. I mean, you can have a bit of power if you're a parent governor. We actually managed to block the appointment of a known TRA, trans radical activist, to a teaching post. But that was one. That's one victory. And, you know, that's just one. You're standing against it. You're standing like King Canute trying to stop the tide.
Surely one of the most incredible examples was that paedophile in Canada. I'm going to Google the name before I say it out loud, just in case. I don't want to get the wrong. No, it wasn't that one. Just as well, I looked it up first. It was a different freak. But yeah,
lawsuits are imminent. Yeah,
yeah. There was this transgender person, I believe of a certain ethnic persuasion, in Canada, who was setting up these workshops for children. And it was just so obvious that something is not right here. And he was posting online about he had an obsession with periods and a girl's first period. He had a clear obsession with prepubescent and pubescent girls.
Yeah.
This guy is being allowed to fraternize with. And I seem to remember that part of it was that parents wouldn't be allowed to attend, so he would be alone.
Of course not. They're not allowed to come.
Absolutely unbelievable that this was going on right in plain view, and people were talking about it online, and yet he was getting away with it.
I know.
And then it's like we get to that stage where you've said what it is, and yet the reality isn't any different. Reality doesn't change just because you express how awful it is. You know, it's like you get to the end of the level and you don't get the reward, you know.
I know. I mean, but when will people learn? I mean, these drag queen story hours and transvestite events, that they don't go to old folks' homes. They don't go and visit the lots of old people here in Australia who sit in aged care in front of a TV screen all day, who might actually welcome a bit of entertainment. They don't visit them. Mm-hmm. They go into little kids. You know?
Yeah.
When will people realise? Yeah. You know, they're not interested in the old folks.
Why does it need to be drag queen story hour? Yeah. Why not? Yeah. Why not some nice old granny who comes around and reads a story to the kids? Why? Why does it have to be a drag queen?
Yeah.
And there is no answer to that other than, well, we want the kids getting into this. It's just really as simple as that. And it's obviously that. Because no one ever needed this before. And that's the thing. No one, this was never necessary. You know, transgender people were not being beaten up in the streets.
No, they weren't.
So the idea that there was some desperate need to increase acceptance of trans matters in society, it was simply not true. Simply not true. So this whole thing is utterly patently unnecessary. The kids do not need drag queen story hour.
And no, they don't. They don't need a man in a dress to read a story to them. They really don't.
No, they don't. Somehow we got through all of human history without this.
Yeah, we did. And what can you say? There are no words, really.
Yeah, I know. It's something where you could easily, as I say, the reality of it is so awful that you think surely everyone else sees it. And I think they do, but they just think, well, I guess there's a variety of things they think. It's not going to happen to my child.
Mm, yes.
If it's happening, then it must be okay. Even though it horrifies me, I must just not understand. Because the government wouldn't do something that was wrong to my child. Or I do think it's wrong, but there's just nothing I can do. So, I think there will be parents who are like that as well, just sort of defeated because they just don't, because it's not in them to protest. Or they've got a job to do.
It's a shame. I mean, people have been conditioned that way. I know that you had the UK column on quite recently, and they've done quite a lot of great work on the kind of mass psychosis and the behavioural psychology that has been worked on the public since World War II to make them, to condition them, to make them docile, to make them not just basically not question things. It's terrible. I mean, I find it very hard because I grew up in a very religious culture in Northern Ireland, and this kind of thing, drag queen story hours were, yeah, it wouldn't. I mean, unfortunately, that whole agenda has got into Northern Ireland now, of course, but back then it's just been unthinkable.
It would have been unthinkable in Scotland.
Yes, I know. Yeah, absolutely. Because Scotland and Northern Ireland are very similar. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I mean, Scotland in the 90s and 80s wasn't a very, terribly religious society. Mm. My school was not a Christian school, but it would have been unthinkable the stuff that kids are now getting. I often think about this, that it was sort of middle of the road, that my teachers were middle of the road, just liberals or normies. But by today's standards, they were fascists.
Yes. Yeah. Mine too.
Yeah.
Very much so. And that sort of thing, I think, in our family, my got involved in the Reverend Ian Paisley's Save Ulster from Sodomy campaign. In the late 70s, which was against, any kind of pro-gay legislation coming in Northern Ireland, and they got very involved in that. I mean, that stuff they were just horrified at the things that they saw going on in England, and they thought that we just don't want that kind of thing in Northern Ireland. And I think Ulster managed to stay in a time cap. The troubles, a lot of these kind of things that some legislation that was passed in mainland UK didn't actually end up applying in Northern Ireland. So we did kind of stay in a bit of a time capsule for quite a long time.
It seems like that. There was a comment posted 3 minutes ago by Bodfer Blarkey.
He's a great friend of mine. He always behaving himself in the chat.
yes, he is.
Behave yourself.
And he says the youth of the future, they can't convince them about World War II and the Boomer Truth regime because they have no connection to the whole.
That's right. They don't. They don't care.
They
don't. Yeah, I don't know how much I can say about this, but some of the children that I make jokes about a certain alleged mid-20th century event. They feel no connection to this. It's not their history. They make jokes about it. Yeah.
Amazing. What Bodfer says is that because they can't convince them about that stuff, the tactic is to destroy their fertility.
Yes.
And the other main weapon is race mixing them with Africans, with white women.
Yes.
So, yeah. Of course, that's non-stop, the propaganda in that direction. It's worth remembering that the propaganda, I mean, it's like the cliche, their propaganda is only necessary because it's demanding something extreme. And the reason there is so much race-mixing propaganda is specifically targeting white women is that it's so, otherwise they just wouldn't do it. It would be extraordinarily rare for a white woman to race mix, if not for the endless media pressure on them to do so.
Yes, I agree. I don't know any mixed race couples.
Well, apparently white women are actually more racially loyal in their dating choices than, I mean, white men have, you know, it's always the yellow fever thing, some Asian cutie.
Yeah, I know that's a real problem here in Australia. You'll see like a nice looking, fit, like kind of successful looking white man in his 20s, and you'll have like when I say Asian, I'll mean like, you know, Chinese, Southeast, that kind of Thai, something like that. Girl hanging on his arm, and that's a real, because for women from that community to get a white Australian man is like, that's kind of like the top of the pinnacle. But they don't want to marry men from their own community, they want to marry a white Australian.
See, I think this is so cruel. This is the cruel part about race mixing. Like, black women cannot compete with white women in terms of the attentions of black men. Black men, you know, if white women are available to them, they are going to go after them rather than black women. Mm-hmm. And in the same way, East Asian men cannot compete with white men when it comes to the attentions of East Asian women.
Absolutely. I mean, it's the same here in Australia. We have a couple of successful Australian rules football players who are Aboriginal, Eddie Betts and Adam Goods. And who are their wives? No, they're not Aboriginal women. They marry white women. So that sounds like that they make a great deal about being proud about their Indigenous roots, and yet they marry a woman outside their community. Mm-hmm. So what's that say?
Well, it's ridiculous. But, you know, apparently that, you must have heard about that silly woman in New England, I think it is, where she's a counsellor and she's organised a thing that's only for counsellors of colour.
Apparently
she's married to a white guy.
I know. It's awful.
I mean, you couldn't make it up. But I remember seeing that there was a meme. I'll have a look through my folder and see if this is put upable, because it might not be. I'll have a look. But it said, it was something like, never ask one of these advocates what race her boyfriend is, basically, because almost always she's with a white guy. Even whilst he moans about white supremacy and all this.
But they know that that's the way the world works, and the status is in having a white partner.
Yeah. Yes, social status comes above ideology and so-called principles. Yeah, I don't seem to have it. Sorry about that, everyone.
And in fairness, you'll hear a lot of white Australian men here will say that, you know, a lot of white Australian women are just awful, and they say that Asian women are maybe more traditional and more servile, and maybe they look after themselves physically a little bit better, that kind of thing. It's a real problem.
Well, this is one of the other results of feminism, that it's made a lot of women uncomfortable. And this is just I understand it doesn't only go one way. I know this. Mm. White men are not like their grandfathers and their great grandfathers. That's a problem as well. But undoubtedly, it's very tangible that white women, and I know it's not all of them. There are plenty of good white women around. Mm. But the cliche today, the stereotype of the millennial woman, the Zoomer woman in her 20s, is just awful. She offers nothing. She just looks down on the guy. She doesn't respect him, doesn't look up to him, will not be led by him, you know, will not allow him to lead, will resent anything in that direction. It doesn't have any of the skills that traditionally are associated with women, like knowing how to cook and all this. So from that point of view, if you're a guy and the dating landscape is full of women like that, then you can understand why the guy would think, you know, I'm just going to get some mail order bride from Thailand.
Yeah.
I mean, it's awful. It's a horrible thing, but I can understand it.
It's awful. It really is. And so many of those young women are just pretty lost. I mean, I don't know if you've seen these videos that are doing the rounds now of young women sitting in cars in tears because they've been working incredibly long shifts and whatever money they've. Morgoth posted about it, and he did an excellent essay about it on his Substack. And this is a reality. They've been sold an absolute pile of lies. They thought they were going to be living Sex in the City, and they've realised that that's just a fantasy. And
even the writer of Sex in the City has come out and
they
said...
They were gay men.
She'd rather have...
Yeah, Candace, that's right. The originator, because it was taken from her... New York Observer column, a lady called Candace Bushnell, and she was the original, the kind of originator. And then, but the series itself, I think, was written by a group of gay men. So kind of, yeah, the writers were gay men living the dream in New York. So it just sold them a lifestyle that's predicated on having endless disposable income, and that's nice, but.
And what works for gay men will not work for women. I'm sorry. It's just completely
absolutely
different.
Unless you can find yourself a Premier League footballer, or you can get yourself on OnlyFans or on Love Island, you're going to struggle to live that world.
Absolutely. But there was another thing I saw on Twitter. I didn't have to see, but when Millennial starts, things become very busy and I don't have time to, so I'll see something on Twitter, but I won't have time to look at it. And I saw this thing yesterday and it was, I think it was PJW shared it. And it was a 35, 40 year old woman who'd suddenly realized that she'd been sold a false bill of goods and she just had a family, but instead she had a career and now it's too late. She can't have kids. And I did see people sort of mocking her, and I thought, fuck, this is just absolutely tragic. And I know that there's not much, I mean, there's nothing to be said except, you can't help her. There's nothing that can be done to help her. All you can do is beseech her to tell younger women not to make the same mistake that she made.
Absolutely.
But I think for a lot of women, in that position, they don't want to admit that it was a mistake. So they'd rather re-enter the delusion and say, well, I just, no man could handle me because I'm so successful.
Yeah, I'm so great. It's just so...
That's why I never settled down. But what we should do, I'm fucking insufferable because of my career. That would be closer to the truth.
Oh, and it's true. And that, I mean, this kind of propaganda is a real thing. When I was at university, I had a female professor who said to all us female students that if you want to succeed in your career, if you want to reach that pinnacle, don't have any children. But if you must have any, just have one. Now, that's the kind of, but I mean, luckily I came from a background where I was pretty impervious to any of this type of stuff because of a very traditional religious upbringing, and I always wanted children. I came from a massive extended family of lots of cousins. I was brought up by cousins, and the thought of having one child or having no children just horrified me. But unfortunately, I mean, of my peer group, I'm the only one that's got one more than one child, and many of them have none and are trying to have IVF now in their 40s on their own, which is just a way, that's just a hole for your money, that is. And because none of those clinics will quite happily take your money, and very few of them will be honest with you and just tell you it's not going to happen, you're too old, just go home.
God, it's terrible.
Yeah, it's tragic, but but all we can do is try and get the message across to young women. You have your children when you're young, when you're young and fit enough to get over it quickly. You can cope with the lack of sleep because babies are labor intensive and hard work, and things like jobs and careers, you can have that later. Those things will always be there, or maybe they won't. Artificial intelligence might take everything from us, but hopefully it won't. And you're going to be working for a long time. This dream of retiring when you're 60 or 65, forget that. You know, when you're 16, 17, you've no idea how your life is going to play out. But one thing's for sure, the biological clock is going to come and hit you over the head at some point. And that's a very, very real thing for women.
Yeah. And I wish we had a culture. Sometimes I think about this, how lovely it would be to have a culture, to live in a culture where this was all in the air, you know. TV shows, posters, billboards, it showed women as mothers. As if that was constantly in the air, that expectation. And I'm sure it used to be. You can look at old news. I've been doing a lot of research recently, and you look at old newspapers, and the adverts are different. You know, it's just a sort of given that people in their 30s will be parents.
Yes.
And people in their 40s will be parents, and people in their 20s will be looking to settle down or have already settled down by 24, as indeed my parents did. And it's lovely, you know, because there's you realize, okay, that's what it takes to just to make this happen. You've got to have it seeded in the culture, this expectation among people that I'll be married by 25. I'll be a parent by 30. And then it would just happen. I don't think it would be some huge struggle. I really don't. I mean,
no, it wouldn't. I mean, you've just got to make motherhood great again. It's been attacked and devalued and trashed by feminism, and you've got to change that.
Oh, absolutely. I just see feminism as the most awful toxin that dissolves. It does so much damage. It's almost like the subtle, insidious damage that it does gets under the radar because everyone's worrying about the burning brass, you know, the obvious stuff. But what it's actually doing is slowly, very subtly poisoning relations between the sexes. Yeah.
It's poisoned everything. It's poisoned the well for men. It's poisoned the well for women. But worst of all, it's poisoned the well for children. And I think people who maybe 10, 20 years ago, women who would have called themselves feminists, if not, like we were talking earlier before we came on air about Posey Parker, Kelly J. Keen. She's someone who was a former feminist and now no longer uses that word because they can see what it has done and they see that actually it has been just co-opted into identity politics, and now the hierarchy of feminism seems to prefer trans men in dresses rather than actual biological women. It seems to have taken on that direction. The intersectionality of it and the identity politics what does it mean anyway? What does it mean to be a feminist now anyway? What are you fighting for?
Yeah, that's a whole thing. And earlier this year, I wrote an essay about the gender criticals who are
I read that. Yeah.
Yeah. They're a group of lefties who and centrists who have turned against the trans thing, but they retain their lefty and centrist worldviews. And it's weird. It's a sort of no man's land that they're in.
No woman's land. They really are absolutely nowhere because feminism doesn't want them. They can't. They just can't. I mean, I met quite a few women like that at the Let Women Speak Posey Parker event here in Melbourne that we talked about. And they're really ideologically homeless. The left doesn't want them. They can't. You know, where the hell do they go?
I don't feel sorry for them. They're ideologically homeless because they haven't realized enough yet. And they should just get their act together, wake up. And then they wouldn't be ideologically homeless anymore. They're ideologically homeless because they refuse to grow. And I'm sorry, but I don't have respect for that. I can't.
Absolutely. Growth and change is really the only sign that we're alive is if we change, the growth and change. And there were quite a few of them at that event and TERFs, you know, trans exclusionary radical feminists. And, you know, that they and I would agree on so many things, but they're still hinged in the left, you know, and issues like abortion. You just got to drop abortion into it and then you'll find that, like, that's like the litmus paper that will tell you where they really are. They just can't take that step. They just can't shed that skin suit of leftism.
Yeah.
But the left doesn't want them anymore, and yet they're holding on to it, and it's just...
Well, but also the whole anti-male thing as well. I mean, it's not just...
That's ridiculous, I know, I know.
They want to keep believing that women are under threat from men. And the thing is, the trans stuff seems to verify that for them, that women are in danger from men because it's men who put a dress on and rape them in prison. And I just hate this because it's like, way to miss the point. You know, you find the one way that you could misunderstand this whole thing. And again, I wish they would wake up. And
it's crazy because if we were really in a patriarchal society, this whole trans thing wouldn't have got a foot in the door. You know what I mean? If we really were in the old days of patriarchy. And, you know, I made a video on my channel about what happened to Posey Parkin when she went to Auckland, and it turned into a complete riot, and the Let Women Speak feminist crowd were nearly ripped to pieces by trans radical and communists, and the people who rescued them were men. There were a group of Christian men in the crowd, and it was the men that got the women out of there. When the hell are they going to realize that they need men? They absolutely need men to support them in this.
Yeah, absolutely. The whole the trans thing is, and some people say that we talk about it too much, but it's so profoundly damaging. It's so profoundly perverse. It's so profoundly at odds with, in terms of social norms. I mean, the vast majority of people should not be trans and never were. And this is why I think this is why it's pushed so much. It's pushed so much because it is so damaging. And as I've said before, I know that, I do think that there are always edge cases. There are always oddities. It's the social norms that matter. And it's the social norms that we should be concerned with. And the only reason to push that, as I said earlier, 20 years ago, no one was pushing this. Apparently, I don't remember this, but apparently when I was a kid, we used to go into a shop in Edinburgh and there was this guy who wore a dress. I don't remember this, but apparently it happened. And we used to go in fairly regularly, but the guy would be sitting behind the counter and he'd be wearing a dress.
And I think we had one of those in Belfast too. We had one of those. And my grandparents' reaction would be, God love him, you know, he should have been born a girl. He should have been born. That was their thinking, that anybody who did this sort of thing obviously should have been born a girl.
Yeah, and it was seen in that way. It was seen as a sort of tragic oddity.
He lived with his R1 lived with his mum on my grandparents' street on the Shankill Road, and they would just say, God love him, like he's a mummy's boy. That was a very kind of Irish reaction, to mummy's boy. That was how they rationalized it. There was no kind of real malice or anger or nastiness towards them. Like you said, they were just seen as kind of eccentrics and a bit sort of odd. And they were my grandparents, oh, he's harmless.
Yeah. The point is that it was an oddity, and it wasn't.
Yeah, it really was.
Nobody would ever have said back then. And it wasn't even the start of this the slippery slope, I don't think. Mm. No one, it was a thing. It was a sort of a mainstay, if you like. Been there for decades, probably, like that. If not longer. And no one was saying, well, therefore, because there's this one person, that therefore everyone should be a commonly accepted and celebrated and promoted thing. Mm. That all happened sort of many years later, and entirely artificially, as I say, really post 2000. Mm. In fact, post 2010, because again, it's easy to forget how different life was just 13 years ago, just 10 years ago.
Oh my goodness. I'm like you. I look back at sort of 2010 like it was some kind of golden age, and it wasn't. It really, really wasn't, you know. But it seems like there was just more sanity back then, and something insane has gripped the world. Yeah.
Certainly. Was there anything else that you want to say about Posey Parkin?
Not really. I mean, that was an interesting event. You know that they got a lot of coverage because of a group here. I think the event just kind of got took over really by other groups. I made a video on it called "Let Women Speak," but no one heard. And they really didn't. It really, the event really got took over by the opposing groups of activists who were there to just really kind of shout at each other. But I think it was an interesting event, and that it did showcase how politically riven Melbourne in particular is, that you have extreme left and every action has a reaction, and therefore we've probably got the strongest dissident right in the whole of Australia in this city, or in Victoria certainly. And that was really interesting. I mean, the fallout from that result has been that the Roman salute has now been banned in Victoria. The swastika was already getting banned the previous year, but the Roman salute has now been banned, which is quite comical because it does cause problems when you're trying to hail a bus or a taxi in Melbourne. You just got to be careful you don't kind of raise your arm too much. to get, you know, there's been a lot of jokes and memes made about that it can be a bit difficult to hail a taxi because there's lots of taxis that go around. But it really showed just how insanely divided this city is, and the fallout from that result or that event is still kind of ongoing, really, in some ways.
I wonder how long all of this has left to go.
I know.
I think they want it to go all the way, but the world changes, as we've been saying on Millennial several times now. I don't know how much longer it can go on. Just because of geopolitical events. Let's certainly hope that it doesn't go too far. Well, it's already gone far too far. You know what I mean?
I know what you mean. It worries me. I mean, I've young children, and you just think, what the hell are they going to have to navigate? I think we all feel like that. What on earth? What's it going to be like in 10 years' time?
Oh, yeah.
What's it going to be like in 20 years' time?
Yeah. I mean, that's something, you know, I'm so glad I'm not an adolescent now.
Oh, good grief. You couldn't pay me to be 15 again? No. No money in the world would pay me to be that age.
No. There are a few super chats.
Oh, great.
I'll get through to get to those now. Sore Arm says, God bless you, Lady of Shalott.
He's a lovely friend.
We've shared our horrors of the tyranny of the Coof.
We have. All of
Australia sounded utter hell. You are well to be horrified of what has happened to Ireland. We have all got to stand together during these dark times. Keep strong, my good lady.
God bless you. Thank you so much. And, have a wonderful, blessed Christmas to you and yours. And just keep going and try and we have to prevail no matter what. We must prevail, because what's the alternative?
Yes, absolutely. Well, the alternative is that our enemies prevail.
And yes, they win.
Yeah, exactly. Reaping Justice. Merry Christmas to Lady of Shalott from her number one simp.
Bless. Thank you so much, Kat. The pleasure, the privilege is mine to quote the Smiths and Morrissey. I actually went to see Morrissey here in Melbourne 2 weeks ago, and it was wonderful. It's a wonderful show.
Good. It's a strange thing with Morrissey over the past years. So Reaping Justice says, lovely to hear your delicious voice on Millennial, a 21st century Christmas tradition. Oh, that's nice. Thank you.
It really is lovely to come. I mean, I've watched, this is the ninth Millennial. I've listened to them even when I was just, I wasn't really in this scene. I was just, teaching kids and it made me think I just wasn't on my own. It's so important because it made me realize I wasn't on my own. I wasn't the only person who felt this way. And it's great to watch you when you're on YouTube, and then obviously now you're on Odyssey.
Well, that was the original idea in 2015. It was the tagline was no reactionary, we'll be alone this Christmas. That was the whole idea. So I'm glad it succeeded.
It did. Thank you.
And he also says, thank you for being your sweet self and raising a bunch of strong kids to make it through this crucible. Happy New Year to you, the family, Woes and Chad. Well, thanks very much, Reaping Justice. It's very kind.
God bless you. And the same to you, Reaping Justice. And you take care of yourself, and yeah, we've got a great community online. I know we have our differences and fallouts and things, but I mean, if our enemies had known what the internet would allow us to do, they would never have. It would have been shut down straight away.
Yes,
because it has allowed it. They would. This would never have been allowed because this is like a lifeline to so many of us.
Yes, yes, it clearly is. I mean, I started it in the first place, my channel, because I was alone. That was the thing. I wanted to know. I wondered, am I the only one who thinks like this? Yeah. How many of us are there?
Yeah.
So prior to that, I'd been on a forum, so I actually with the Franklin.
Yes, the Franklin,
Oddly enough. But apart from that, I hardly knew anyone. So that's how it all started. And then Hinchfoot says, COVID was the excuse for all the governments of the world to exhibit their worst traits. Yes.
Yes,
it was. Yeah, and what was scary was how good at it they were, how competent they suddenly were.
Absolutely, and I think what shocked me was just how cruel, their cruelty to, they locked up old people, and we know that they just basically killed those old people by locking them up. They've damaged the development of children. I'm teaching children now who are 2 years behind where they should be because they learn to speak late, because the children learn to speak by observing adults very often, and all the adults they knew were wearing masks. And, you know, God knows that the damage that this has done will take probably decades to play out, and some of it may not be able to be fixed. And it's horrible. Can you imagine being a little child during that time?
Oh, no, I can't.
Yeah.
Yeah. As you say, they did a lot of damage.
Yeah, and, they did.
They should never be forgiven. Salmon of Knowledge says, great discussion. Another excellent guest. Thank you very much.
Oh, thank you. You're so kind. Thank you very much.
Conservative says, but did you know the Dems founded the KKK?
They did. Yeah, they did indeed.
Thank you for reminding us of that, Conservative. Vlady says, have you read Alinsky's Rules for Radicals? Not all of his tactics can be adapted for the right, but it's a good starting point. Yes.
Yes.
I haven't read the book, but I know the rules very well. I've read them many times. And yeah, there is. It's certainly interesting. Yes. Yeah, indeed. Jay Ray says, thank you. Well, thank you. Says, I think backlit screen viewing is one of the biggest contributors to why homosexuality and transsexualism have become so prevalent and why men have less testosterone than they used to. Backlit screen viewing disrupts our ability to get REM sleep, which is when most hormone production happens. That's interesting. I didn't know that.
Oh, completely. And I think, lack of sleep's the worst, the worst thing, isn't it? And I think how many of us would feel our life would be better if we could sleep a bit, have more improved sleep. And sleep deprivation is a form of torture. And when somebody messes with your sleep, it's, so when you just have a small baby and you realize that, but lack of sleep's horrible. And absolutely.
Dino says, first time I have heard Lady of Shalott. Very grateful for the stream and thank you both. Well, thank you.
Oh, thank you.
Living the Dream says, thanks for 2 hours of rage-inducing topics, lol. Sorry, I didn't intend it.
Sorry.
To be. Yeah. And then Open Borders says, big fan of Lady of Shalott.
Oh, thank you.
Woz,
he's here in Australia. He's a fellow sufferer here in Melbourne. I know him. Yeah.
Right. Okay. And then he says that I need to get on the Unshackled show here in Australia.
I have a friend here called Tim Wilms who runs he has a great little YouTube channel and a website. And I'm hoping to start to write some articles, and Open Borders is going to write for him as well on his website. And Tim mentioned on the show last night, I think that he tried to reach out to you, Woz, but you were having a break from broadcasting at that time. I can send you his email because he's a great, he knows, he's a straight, he's lived here all his life and he knows all the kind of things that have gone on here, and he's a mine of information, and he'd be a really interesting person to talk to. He lives here.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you, Open Borders.
Okay. And then Black Pigeon Pilled finally says, does Lady of Shalott think that transgenderism, transhumanism, etc., entails ultimately the creeping abolition of natural sex?
Inevitably, I think, yeah. Won't it? Because transgenderism is just another step on the road to transhumanism. And yeah, I'd say so. I mean, I can't say.
Yeah.
How on earth are they going to get jiggy?
God almighty.
Doesn't bear thinking about, really, does it?
No, it really doesn't. It's very unfortunate. Let's not end on that note, because that's hideous. Yeah.
I've just realised, we didn't get round to talking about the voice, the Indigenous voice to Parliament referendum hearings, which we were going to talk about. Not to worry, because I can just tell everyone that Vote No won. And the libtards were very upset. And they're going to now just try and sneak it in through the back door anyway.
But, yeah, I wondered about that. They'll just do the same thing.
Absolutely. They can use the state federal apparatus to try and sneak it in through the states. We actually already have one of these Indigenous parliaments here that none of us were consulted on or got to vote on here in Victoria. But, you know, that they'll say things, they've said things like, well, the Australian public spoke and we listened, you're not ready for it at this point, but, and then you know what they're like. These people are snakes. They don't care what we think, really.
No. Well, not yet, anyway. All right. Well, let's close it there. This has been a very good
That was evening. Wonderful. Thank you. And thank you so much. And it was a real privilege to come on here. I've been a fan for years and I've been loving that you've had some great guests on. It was great. You were speaking to John Waters last week, who's been a long time hero of mine over in Ireland.
Yes. He's great. Yeah. It's always interesting with him.
It is.
All right. Well, thank you very much. I've enjoyed this. I think the
Me
audience
too.
Has as well.
Oh, thank you. And a blessed Christmas to everyone in the audience. God bless you and take care of yourself. And in the words of Marcus Aurelius, waste no more time arguing about what a good man should be. Be one.
Yes, absolutely. Set an example. Yes.
Yeah, read the Stoics. Get someone to get you some Marcus Aurelius or some Stoics over Christmas and read those.
All right. Okay. Well, I'll be back very soon with the final stream for tonight. In the meantime, Lady of Shalott, thank you for appearing on Millennial 2023.
Oh, thank you. Thank you so much. Thank you, everyone.
Excellent. Bye-bye for now.
We hope you're enjoying Millennial. The journey must continue, but it needs your help. T-shirts and mugs and other wondrous gifts are available at the merchandise store. Impress your family, friends, colleagues, and business partners with these incredible items.
All aboard!
Millennial amounts to 3 months of work for the vile vlogger. Please help him continue. Until next time, enjoy the journey and spread the word. We'll be right back.